This is a reading of a small cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, three lectures, entitled The Spiritual Foundation of Morality, Francis of Assisi and the Christ Impulse, given in Norrköping, Sweden, from May 28th to the 30th, 1912. Lecture 1, May 28th, 1912. In accordance with a certain impulse of mine, about which we may be able to speak further, we will be taking up in the coming days one of the most important and vital areas of theosophical study. We are indeed often reproached for wanting to study the human being's connection with broad developments in the spiritual cosmos, for wishing to consider far distant events of the past and far-reaching perspectives of the future, while almost completely disregarding the realm that is nearest us, the realm of human morals and human ethics. It is quite true that this realm of human morals must be regarded as one of the most essential, but it must also be said that we feel able to approach this subject only with the greatest reverence and respect, particularly if we experience the full significance of the theosophical conception of life. We realize that it will touch us as closely as anything can, if it is to be considered in the right way, and that it therefore calls for the most serious and worthy preparation. Footnote number 1. During these lectures, Steiner does not, in fact, explicitly speak further about his impulse for discussing the topic of morality. End of footnote. The reproach that is made against us could perhaps be expressed in the following manner. What is the use of making deep studies of the universe? Why talk about numerous reincarnations or the complicated conditions of karma, when surely the most important thing in life is what was repeatedly said by a certain wise man to his followers after he had attained the summit of a rich life of wisdom, indeed after he had grown so weak and ill that he had to be carried, quote, "Children, love one another." Close quote. These words were uttered by John the Evangelist when he was a very old man. And it has often been said that these four words contain the essence of the deepest moral wisdom. And so many might ask, what more is needed if goodness, if sublime moral ideals, can be fulfilled so simply as implied by these words of John the Evangelist? Footnote number 2. St. John the Evangelist, 1st century A.D., writer of the fourth gospel, the epistles of John, and the book of Revelation. On his precept of love, see titled The Golden Legend of Jacobus de Voragine, page 63. End of footnote. Something is overlooked when the fact of the importance of morality leads people to believe that it is sufficient to know that they should love one another. What is overlooked is that he who uttered these words did so at the close of a rich life of wisdom, a life which included the writing of the most profound and important of the Gospels. He who uttered these words acquired the right to do so only at the end of this rich life of wisdom. He who has lived a life such as this is justified in distilling the deep wisdom contained in the Gospel of St. John into the words just spoken, words which may then also flow out of unfathomable depths of soul into the depths of other hearts and souls. He who is not in such a position, however, must first go deeply into the secret foundations of the world, and thereby earn the right to express the highest moral truths in such a simple manner. The oft-repeated saying, quote, "When two persons say the same thing, it is not the same," close quote, may be trivial, but it is especially valid in this case. When someone who simply refuses to know or understand anything of the mysteries of the world says, quote, "It is really quite simple to describe the highest moral life," close quote, and then uses the words, "Children love one another," this is quite different from the evangelist John's saying these words. For this reason, someone who understands these words of John ought to draw from them a quite different conclusion than is usually drawn. The conclusion should be that one has first of all to be silent about such profoundly significant words, and that they may be uttered only if one has gone through the necessary preparation and reached the necessary maturity. But now that we have made this statement, which will certainly have struck a deep chord with some of you, something quite different will come to mind, something of profound importance. You will say to yourself, quote, "It may be true that the deepest significance of moral principles can be understood only at the end of the path of wisdom, but despite this, they are used all the time. How would it be possible to foster any kind of moral community or social endeavor if one had to wait for knowledge of the highest ethical principles until the end of the path of wisdom? Morality is what is most necessary for human social life. Yet here it is asserted that moral principles can be acquired only at the culmination of a long striving for wisdom." Close quote. At this point, some might say that if this were so, they would begin to doubt the wise arrangement of the world, if what is needed most could be gained only at the conclusion of human striving. The answer to what has just been outlined is amply given by life itself. You need only compare two cases, which are, no doubt, well known to you in one form or another, and you will at once perceive that both assertions can be correct, that we attain to the highest ethical principles and their understanding only at the conclusion of our striving for wisdom, and also that moral and social communities and endeavors cannot exist without morality. Who has not known someone who was highly developed intellectually, who may have possessed not just a clear intellectual grasp of natural science, but also a good theoretical and practical understanding of many spiritual truths, and yet was not a particularly moral person? Who has not seen clever and highly intelligent people going morally astray? Yet, who has not also experienced the other situation, from which we may learn so much? Who has not known someone with a very restricted intellectual horizon and limited knowledge? For example, a nanny who raised not her own children but those of her employers. She may have nurtured those children from the very first weeks of their physical existence, helped them in their education, and perhaps spent her entire life sacrificing everything for them in an absolutely selfless way, with the utmost devotion imaginable. Yet if anyone had come to her with moral axioms derived from the very highest founts of wisdom, she probably would not have been much interested. She probably would have found them quite unintelligible and useless. But what she accomplished morally, this is more effective than any acknowledgement of moral axioms. Such cases often cause us to bow down in awe before that which streams from the heart into life and creates so much goodness. Such facts often answer the riddles of life far more clearly than do theoretical explanations. We see here that a wise providence did not wait until people had found the moral principles before providing the world with moral conduct. Thus, if we temporarily disregard immoral acts, whose cause we shall get to know in these lectures, we may say that a divine heritage exists within the human soul, an original goodness that could be called instinctive goodness, which makes it possible for humanity to endure until the moral principles have been discovered. But perhaps it is quite unnecessary to trouble ourselves so much about discovering moral principles. Might it not be said that it is best if people trust their original moral instincts and do not perplex themselves with theoretical explanations about morality? That this too is not so is just what these lectures are meant to show. They are meant to show that it is necessary for us, at least in the present epoch of humanity, to seek for a theosophical understanding of morality. This understanding must be a task that arises as a fruit of our whole theosophical effort and theosophical science. Besides much that is quite erroneous in the philosophy of Schopenhauer, a modern philosopher, who is certainly also known here in the North, he did say something regarding the principles of morality that is quite correct. He has said, quote, "To preach morality is easy, to establish morality is difficult." Close quote. Footnote 3, Arthur Schopenhauer, 1788 to 1860, German philosopher. The quotation is from Preisschrift über die Grundlagen der Moral. End of footnote. This statement is very true, for almost nothing is easier than to pronounce in a manner appealing to the broadest human sentiments what a person ought to do or leave undone in order to be a good person. Some people might be offended when this is said to be easy, but easy it is. And anyone who knows life, anyone who knows the world, will not doubt that scarcely anything has been more discussed than the correct principles of ethical conduct. And it is particularly true that one meets with almost universal approval when one speaks of these general principles of ethics. It feels so pleasant to the audience. They feel so strongly that they can agree with what the speaker is saying when he discourses on the very broadest principles of human morality. Moral teaching and moral preaching, however, do not establish morality. Truly not. If morality could be established in this fashion, there would certainly be no immorality at this time. Humanity would be overflowing with moral actions, for everyone without question has had many opportunities to hear the most beautiful moral principles, especially as people are so fond of preaching them. But knowing what one ought to do, what is morally correct, is of least importance in this realm. What is of most importance, on the other hand, is that there should be impulses living within us, which, through their inward strength, their inward power, translate themselves into moral actions. As is well known, moral sermons do not produce this result. Morality can be established only if human beings are guided to sources from which they can receive the impulses that lead to moral conduct. Just how difficult it is to find these sources is shown by the simple fact that innumerable attempts have been made, for example, from the philosophical side, to found a system of ethics, a code of morals. Think how many different answers have been given to the question, what is the good, or what is virtue? Try collecting all that the philosophers have said, beginning with Plato and Aristotle, passing through the Epicureans, the Stoics, the Neoplatonists, and down the whole series to the modern philosophers. Collect all that has been said about the nature of goodness and virtue, let us just say from Plato to Herbert Spencer, and you will see how many different attempts there have been to penetrate to the sources of moral life and moral impulses. In these lectures, I hope to show that only by delving into the occult secrets of life can one advance, not merely to moral doctrines, but to moral impulses, to the moral sources of life. A single glance suffices, however, to show us that this business of morality is by no means such a simple matter as might be conveniently supposed. Let us for the moment take no notice of what is usually regarded as moral, and instead consider certain human cultures that may perhaps greatly assist us in developing a moral conception of life. There's a footnote, number 4. As used by Steiner, quote, occultism, close quote, refers to the sacred wisdom that has been cultivated through the ages in esoteric schools known as mystery centers or mysteries. When translated into conceptual form, this wisdom becomes theosophy, also called anthroposophy or spiritual science. End of footnote. Among the many things we learn through occultism, not the least is that very diverse conceptions and impulses have held sway among the various peoples in the different parts of the earth. To begin with, then, let us compare two widely separate regions of humanity. Let us go back to the sacred life of ancient India and observe how it unfolded little by little right up into recent times. More so than anywhere else, what was characteristic in ancient times of India and several other Asiatic lands has been preserved right into recent times. The feelings and the thoughts that were found in this region in ancient times have continued into modern times. It is extraordinary how in these cultures an image of former times has been preserved, how when we consider what has been maintained up to our own day, we are at the same time, as it were, looking into the remote past. Now, we will not progress very far in our understanding of the different peoples on earth if from the beginning we just apply our own moral standards. For this reason, let us for the moment exclude what might be said about the morality of those times and ask only what has developed from these characteristic features of the ancient Indian culture. To begin with, we find there that what is most highly revered and respected is what we may call devotion or surrender to the spiritual. And this devotion to the spiritual is the more highly revered the more one is able to sink into oneself, to live within oneself in quietude, and to direct the best in oneself to the heights of the spiritual world, ignoring everything in the physical world. We find that this devotional surrender of the soul to the foundations of existence is the highest duty of those who belonged or belong to the highest caste of Indian life, the Brahmins. Everything they do, all their impulses are directed in this way, and nothing impresses the moral sensitivities of the Indian people more than this turning to the divine spiritual in a mood of deep introspection and self-renunciation, with a devotion that forgets everything physical. The extent to which this attitude permeates the ethical life of this culture may be seen from another fact, namely that those who belonged to the other castes, especially in ancient times, considered it quite natural for the caste of devotion, the caste of the religious life, to be set apart and venerated. Their whole culture was thus imbued with this impulse to turn to the divine spiritual, and all of life was placed in service to this. What is involved here cannot be understood with general moral axioms, because in the period when these feelings and impulses were developing in ancient India, it was as yet impossible for them to develop among other peoples. These impulses required the temperament and fundamental character of exactly the Indian people in order to develop the intensity that they did. In the course of civilization, they then radiated out from India and spread over the rest of the earth. If we wish to understand what is meant by the divine spiritual, we must go to this primal source. Let us now turn our attention away from the Indian culture and direct it toward Europe. Let us consider the peoples of Europe in the period when Christianity was just beginning to enter European culture. You all know that the Christianity spreading into Europe from the east and south was confronted, as it were, by quite definite impulses in the peoples of Europe, by quite definite inner values and forces. One who studies the history of the introduction of Christianity into Central Europe, and also here in the North, especially one who studies this with occult means, knows at what cost the balance was struck between this or that Christian impulse and what met it from Northern and Central Europe. And now let us ask, as we have already done in the case of the Indian people, what were the prevailing ethical impulses, the moral treasures, the moral heritage brought to Christianity by those people whose descendants constitute the present European population, especially the population of the North, Central Europe, and England? We need only mention a single one of the principal virtues, and we know at once that we are expressing something that is truly characteristic of these Northern and Central European peoples. The chief virtue brought by the Europeans to Christianity is expressed in the words courage or fortitude, the exercise of all the force of one's personality toward actualizing in the physical world one's innermost intentions. The further back we go in time, the more we find that the other virtues are basically derived from this virtue. If we consider the fundamental nature of true fortitude or courage, we find that it consists of an inner fullness of life that can issue forth. This fullness of life was the most salient characteristic among the ancient inhabitants of Europe. They had within themselves more fullness of life than they could use. And so, quite instinctively, they followed the impulse to disperse that which they had in superabundance. One could even say that they were wasteful in letting their moral abundance, their fitness, their life impulses pour out into the physical world. Individuals belonging to the ancient European people contained in themselves more than they needed for their own personal use. From this superfluity they could overflow, could be prodigal, could perform their warlike deeds, those deeds of ancient virtue that in modern times are classed as vices. From this superfluity they could also be magnanimous and generous. Acting out of generosity was characteristic of the people of ancient Europe, just as acting out of devotion was characteristic of the people of ancient India. Theoretical moral axioms would have been of no use to the people of ancient Europe. They would have evinced little understanding for them. Preaching morality to an ancient European would have been like giving someone who does not like math the advice that they ought to precisely record their receipts and expenditures. If such a person does not want to, and if the circumstance is such that they have enough to cover their expenses, then they do not need to. If their source is inexhaustible, they can dispense with precise bookkeeping. This circumstance is not unimportant. It applies, in principle, to everything that a person considers of value in life, to everything that engages one's personal activity. With respect to mundane matters, it also applies to the moral feelings of the inhabitants of ancient Europe. Each one had received a divine legacy, as it were, and felt full of it and spent it in service to the family or the tribe, or also in service to larger folk groupings. That was the way they worked and went about life. We have now characterized two great regions of humanity that are quite different from one another, for the feeling of devotion natural to the Indians did not exist at all among the Europeans. That was why Christianity found it so difficult to bring this feeling of devotion to the Europeans. Their predisposition was entirely different. With these considerations in mind, let us now inquire into their moral effect, without introducing any objections based on moral concepts. It does not take much reflection to see that when these two ways of looking at the world, these two trends of feeling, encountered each other in their purest form, the moral effect was immense. The world has gained infinitely much from what could be achieved only through the existence of a people like the ancient Indians, where all feeling was directed to the devotional surrender to the highest. But the world has also gained infinitely much, and this could be shown in detail, from the courageous deeds of the European peoples of early pre-Christian times. Both of these qualities had to cooperate, and together they have yielded a moral result that has benefited not just a portion of humanity, but all of humanity. In everything that humanity today regards as the highest, we can still see the effect from India, as well as the effect from ancient Europe. Can we say now, without further ado, that this moral result for humanity is, in quotes, the good? Yes, we can, without a doubt. Certainly within both of these cultures it must be the good, and something must exist that we can designate as the good. Yet, if we wish to say what the good is, we are, again, confronted by a riddle. What is the good which has worked in the one case as well as in the other? I do not wish to give you a moral sermon, for I do not consider this to be my task. Rather, I regard it as my task to present facts to you which can lead to a theosophical conception of morality. For this reason, I have, initially, placed before you two sets of known historical facts, and I ask you to note only that the fact of devotion and the fact of courage produce definite moral effects in the cultural evolution of humanity. Let us now turn our attention to a different time period. If you look at the moral impulses present in modern life, you will naturally say that today, at least in Europe, we cannot conform to the purest ideal of ancient India, because European culture cannot be maintained with Indian devotionalism. But it would be just as impossible for us to gain modern European culture with the ancient European people's praiseworthy virtue of fortitude. We see at once that there is still something different about the ethics of the ancient Europeans. We must search still further, therefore, to be able to answer the question, what is goodness? What is virtue? I have often pointed out that we have to distinguish between the period we call the Greco-Latin, or fourth post-Atlantean cultural epoch, and the fifth post-Atlantean epoch, which we live in at the present time. Footnote here, Steiner number 5, Steiner distinguishes seven cultural epochs within the post-Atlantean age, the age that began with the deluge, destroyed the continent of Atlantis. The chronology of these seven epochs is roughly as follows. The ancient Indian is from the 8th to the 6th millennium BCE. The ancient Persian is from the 6th to the 3rd millennium BCE. The Chaldaic Egyptian is from the 3rd to the 1st millennium BCE. The Greco-Latin is from the 8th century BCE to the 15th century AD. The 5th or present post-Atlantean epoch is from the 15th century AD to the 4th millennium AD. The 6th post-Atlantean epoch will be from the 4th to the 6th millennium AD. And the 7th post-Atlantean epoch will be from the 6th to the 8th millennium AD. For a description of the individual epochs, see Steiner's An Outline of Esoteric Science. End of footnote number 5. And what I have now to say regarding the nature of morality is really intended to characterize the origin of the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. Let us begin with something which you may consider open to doubt, since it is taken from poetry and legend, but which is still characteristic of the way that fresh moral impulses became active and gradually flowed into humanity as the fifth post-Atlantean epoch began to unfold. There was a poet who lived around the end of the 12th century and beginning of the 13th. He died in the year 1213, and he was known as Hartmann von Aue. I'm pronouncing Aue, A-U-E. Footnote number 6, Hartmann von Aue, 1160 to 1213, Mittelheide German Minnesinger and epic poet. His epic poem, Die Arme Heinrich, was written between 1190 and 1197. The end of footnote number 6. This poet's most important poem, Der Arme Heinrich, Poor Henry, was written completely out of the mode of thinking and feeling prevalent in his day. It expresses especially well how certain moral impulses were regarded in particular circles and regions at that time. This is the gist of it. Originally, Poor Henry was not poor, but was a rich and well-appointed knight. He took no account, however, that the sense-perceptible things of the physical world are but transient and fleeting. He lived only for the world and rapidly engendered unfavorable karma. He was thus stricken with a form of leprosy, and although he visited all the most celebrated physicians, none of them could help him. So, giving up his life for lost, he sold all his possessions, and, because his disease did not allow him to live in society, retired to a solitary farm where he was loyally nursed by an old devoted servant and the servant's daughter. One day the daughter and the whole household learn that there is only one thing that can help the knight who has this destiny. No physician, no medicines can help him. Only if a pure virgin sacrifices her life for him out of love can his health be restored. In spite of all the exhortations of her parents and of the knight Henry himself, something comes over the daughter which makes her believe that she is the one who should sacrifice herself. So she goes with the knight to Salerno, the most celebrated medical school of the time, and does not shrink from what the physicians require of her. She is ready to sacrifice her life. But the knight does not allow this to happen. He prevents it and returns home with her. The poem then tells us that when the knight returned home, he actually began to recover, and that he lived for a long time and spent a happy old age with the one who had been determined to save him. Well, you may say, this is a poem, after all, and we need not take literally the things spoken of here. But the matter begins to look different when we compare what Hartmann von Auer wrote in Der arme Heinrich with something that we know actually happened, when we compare what Hartmann von Auer expressed with the life and deeds of an actual person living in Italy at that time. I mean Francis of Assisi, who was born in 1182. Footnote number 7, St. Francis of Assisi, 1182 to 1226, founder of the Franciscan Order of Monks. End of footnote. Now, in order to describe the moral nature that was concentrated, as it were, in the single personality of Francis of Assisi, let us consider the matter as it appears to the occult investigator, even if this causes us to appear foolish and superstitious. Let us take seriously what I am going to describe, for in that time of transition these things were taken very seriously. We know that Francis of Assisi was the son of the Italian merchant Bernardone and his wife. We know that his father travelled a great deal in France, where he carried on his business, and that he was a man who placed great value on outer appearances. The mother of Francis of Assisi had the virtue of piety and other fine qualities of the heart, and lived devoutly according to her religious feelings. Now, the things that are recounted in the form of legends about the birth and the life of Francis of Assisi are entirely in agreement with occult facts. Although history frequently veils occult facts in pictures and legends, these legends do correspond with the occult facts. Thus it is quite true that before the birth of Francis of Assisi, a great number of people knew, through visionary revelations, that an important person was about to be born. History records that one of the many people who dreamt, that is, who saw in prophetic vision, that an important person was about to be born, was St. Hildegard. Footnote 8, St. Hildegard of Bingen, 1098 to 1179, abbess at the Benedictine convent at Rupertsberg by Bingen in Germany. End of footnote. I must emphasize once more the truth of these facts, which can be corroborated by investigations in the Akasha Chronicle. That's footnote number 9. The Akasha Chronicle is a living script of the spiritual history of the world. For further details, see Steiner title Cosmic Memory, or title The Gospel of St. John and Its Relation to the Other Gospels, Lecture 2. The end of the footnote. She dreamt that a woman appeared to her, whose face was scratched and covered with blood, and who said, quote, "The birds have their nests here upon the earth, the foxes too have their holes, but at present I have nothing, not even a staff to lean on." Close quote. When Hildegard awakened, she knew that this personality represented the true face of Christianity. Footnote number 10. The dream vision is described by St. Hildegard in a letter to the priest Werner of Kirchheim. Long quote. "When, in the year 1170, after the incarnation of the divine, I lay in my sickbed for a long time, I saw, while I was awake, in both body and spirit, the form of a very beautiful lady. She was a woman of exquisite charm, so attractive in her loveliness and possessed of such beauty that the human spirit was unable to comprehend it. Her form towered above the earth all the way up to the heavens. Her face sparkled with the most incredible brightness. Her eyes looked up to heaven. She was clothed in a brightly radiant robe of white silk, and in a cloak decorated with costly jewels, emeralds, sapphires, and pearls, both large and small. On her feet she wore shoes made of onyx, but her face was smudged with dust, and her dress was torn on the right side. Her cloak, too, had lost its exquisite beauty, and the tops of her shoes were soiled. She cried to high heaven with a loud plaintive voice, and said, quote, "Hear me, O heaven, for my countenance is sullied, Mourn, O earth, for my robe is torn. Tremble, O abyss, for my shoes are soiled. The foxes have their holes, and the birds of the sky have their nests, but I have no helper, no consoler, not even a staff to lean on that might give me some support. Close quote. And she went on to say, quote, I was hidden in the heart of the divine, until the Son of Man, conceived and born in virginity, poured out his blood. It was this blood that was his dowry when he married me, so that I might bring forth anew, in the pure and simple rebirth in the spirit and in water, those who were stunted and sullied by the venom of the spirit. Priests are supposed to be those who nourish me, who see to it that my face sparkles like the morning light, that my robe shines like lightning, that my cloak radiates like costly jewels, and that my shoes brightly gleam. But instead they cover my face with dust, tear my robe, and make my cloak dark and my shoes black. Those who should be beautifying me in every way have been faithless and have totally abandoned me. The wounds of my bridegroom, Christ, remain fresh and open as long as the wounds of the open human race's sins are open. And I heard a voice from heaven which said, quote, this image represents the church, close quote, close the long quote. For the full description of this dream vision, see Hildegard of Bingen's Book of Divine Works, pages 328 to 331. On the theme of the bride and the bridegroom, compare the Book of Revelation, chapter 19, verses 7 and 8, chapter 21, verses 1 and 2 and 9. End of footnote number 10. And many other persons dreamt in a similar manner. They realized that the external institution of the church was unfit to be a receptacle, a sheath for the real Christianity. One day, while Francis's father was on business in France, this again is a fact, a pilgrim came to Donna Pica's house to the mother of Francis of Assisi and said to her, quote, the child you are expecting must not be born in this house, where there is abundance. You must give birth to him in the stable, for he must lie upon straw and so follow after his master. Close quote. This was actually said to the mother of Francis of Assisi. And it is not legend but truth that because the father was in France on business, the mother was able to carry this out, so that Francis of Assisi was actually born in a stable upon straw. And another thing is also true. Some time after the child was born, a strange man came into the little town, a man never been seen in that neighborhood before and never seen there again. He went back and forth through the streets, saying, quote, an important person has been born in this town, close quote. And those persons who could still lead a healthy visionary life also heard bells ringing at the time of the birth of Francis of Assisi. A whole series of phenomena could be mentioned, but we will content ourselves with these, which have been mentioned only to show how everything from the spiritual world was meaningfully concentrated relative to the advent of a single person of that time. And this all becomes especially interesting when one further thing is considered. The mother had the peculiar impression that the child ought to be called John, and he was therefore given this name. When the father returned, however, he gave his son the name Francis, because he wished to commemorate his successful business journey to France. But originally the child was named John. Footnote 11. Compare Steiner's indication that John is an occult name for someone who has reached a certain stage of spiritual development, namely the complete purification of the soul, or in occult terminology, the transformation of the astral body into the spirit self. On another occasion, Steiner states explicitly that Francis of Assisi had a completely purified astral body, and that's from the lecture cycle Cosmogony, 1906. End of footnote. We need to dwell now on just a few details from the life of this remarkable man, especially from his youth. What sort of a person was Francis of Assisi as a youth? He was someone who conducted himself like a descendant of the ancient Germanic warriors, which need not appear remarkable to us if we consider how the peoples had intermixed after the immigrations from the north. He was brave and warlike, and filled with the ideal of winning honor and fame with the weapons of war. That was what existed like a heritage, like a racial characteristic in the personality of Francis of Assisi. He also expressed in a more general way, one might say, the same qualities that existed as a more inward quality of soul in the ancient Germans, for in his youth Francis of Assisi was what one calls a spendthrift. At every opportunity he squandered the possessions of his father, who was at the time a rich man. Francis lavished the fruits of his father's labor on all his comrades and playfellows. Little wonder, then, that his comrades chose him to lead their youthful, warlike expeditions, and that as he grew up he was looked upon as a truly warlike boy, for such was his reputation throughout the whole town. He took part in the various feuds between the youths of the towns of Assisi and Perugia, and it thus came about on one occasion that he and his comrades were taken prisoner. He then not only bore his own captivity in knightly fashion, but also inspired the others to do the same, until after a year they were able to return home. Later on, when a military expedition against Naples was being prepared, which those in the knighthood were required to join, it happened that this young man had a dream vision. He saw a great palace, wherein were stored all kinds of weapons and shields. Prior to this, he had seen in his father's house and place of business only numerous kinds of cloth, and thus he said to himself, "This is a summons for me to become a soldier." So he resolved to join the expedition against Naples. But as he was preparing to do this, and even more so after he had joined the expedition, he received spiritual impressions, spiritual messages. He heard something like a voice which said, "Go no further. You have wrongly interpreted this important dream. Go back to Assisi, and you will learn how to interpret it correctly." He obeyed these words, went back to Assisi, and there had something like an inner dialogue with a being who spoke to him spiritually and said, quote, "Do not seek your knighthood in external service. You are destined to transform all the forces at your disposal into powers of soul, into weapons to be used by your soul. The weapons you saw in the palace signify the spiritual weapons of mercy, compassion, and love. The shields signify the good sense you must exercise in order to withstand the trials of a life dedicated to mercy, compassion, and love." Close quote. Thereafter, he had a short but dangerous illness. He recovered from this and then passed through something like a retrospect of his whole life, which lasted for several days. The young knight, who in his boldest dreams had only longed to become a hero in battle, was reforged, as it were, into a man who was now utterly dedicated to spreading the moral impulses of mercy, compassion, and love. All the forces that he had wanted to use in service to the physical world were transformed into inner moral impulses. We see here how a moral impulse is aroused in a single person. It is not unimportant that in this case we are studying a great moral impulse, for although an individual person cannot always attain to the greatest ethical heights, it is only where impulses are expressed most radically and with the greatest forcefulness that an individual can learn from them. It is precisely by turning our attention to what is most radical, and by considering lesser things in the light of this radical greatness, that we come to a correct conception about the moral impulses of life. What happened next to Francis of Assisi? It is not necessary to describe the disputes he had with his father, as he now became prodigal in an entirely different manner. The father could understand his son's earlier extravagance, which was also advantageous in that it brought his house fame and esteem, but he could not understand now how his son could cast off his best clothes and even his necessities and give them to those in need. And the father could not understand his son's frame of mind when the son said, quote, "It is remarkable how little respect is given to those who have done so much for the Christian impulse in the West," close quote, and then proceeded to make a pilgrimage to Rome to lay a large sum of money at the graves of the apostles Peter and Paul. These things his father did not understand. I need not describe the disputes that took place. I need only point out that for Francis of Assisi, all the impulses of morality became concentrated through these disputes. These concentrated impulses transformed the fortitude in his soul, and then developed in such a way that they were greatly strengthened by his meditations, and appeared before him as the cross with the crucified one. In this condition he felt an inner, personal relationship to the cross and to the Christ, and from this relationship there then came to him the forces that could augment so immeasurably the moral impulses that now filled him. He found a remarkable use for what now unfolded within him. In those days the horrors of leprosy had spread over many parts of Europe, and the Church had come up with a strange cure for the lepers, who were then so numerous. The priests would call the lepers and say to them, quote, "You are stricken with this disease in this life, but inasmuch as you are lost to this life, you have been won for God. You are consecrated to God." Close quote. Then, however, the lepers were sent away from other people to desolate places where they had to spend the rest of their lives alone. I do not want to blame the priests for this kind of cure. They knew no better. But Francis of Assisi knew a better one. I am mentioning all this because it will lead us to the sources of morality from actual experience. You will see in the next lectures why we are dealing with these things. Francis of Assisi was impelled by this state of affairs to go everywhere and search out all the lepers and to be unafraid of associating with them. And in fact, that which none of the remedies of the time could cure, and which therefore made it necessary to exclude these people from human society, this sickness was healed by Francis of Assisi in numberless cases. He went to the lepers with the power that existed in his moral impulses, and these allowed him no fear, but rather gave him the courage not only to carefully cleanse their sores, but also to live with them, to nurse them fully, even to kiss them, to transfuse them with his love. Footnote number 12, compare title The Little Flowers of St. Francis, chapter 25, how St. Francis miraculously healed a man with leprosy in soul and body. End of footnote 12. The healing of poor Henry by the daughter of his faithful servant is not just a poetic story. It expresses what actually occurred in a great number of cases at that time through the historically well-known personality of Francis of Assisi. Note carefully what took place there. In someone like Francis of Assisi, there existed a tremendous fund of psychic energy, something which had existed as courage and fortitude in the ancient peoples of Europe, but which, in him, had been transformed, and thereafter acted on the level of soul and spirit. Just as what worked as generosity and fortitude in ancient times had led to an expenditure of personal force, and had manifested in Francis of Assisi in his younger days as compulsive extravagance, so this now led him to become prodigal of moral force. He was full to overflowing with moral force, and this passed over to those to whom he turned his love. You must realize that this moral force is a reality, just as much a reality as the air we breathe, without which we could not live. It is a reality which flooded the whole being of Francis of Assisi, and from there streamed into every heart he turned to. For Francis of Assisi was prodigal of a wealth of forces. This reality is something that has streamed into and mingled with the whole mature life of Europe. It is something that has been transformed into a force of soul and worked in this way into the outer world. Try to reflect on these facts, which at first may apparently have nothing to do with the actual question of morality. Try to grasp what is contained in Indian devotion and Nordic courage. Think about the healing effect of such moral forces as were exercised by Francis of Assisi. Then, tomorrow, we shall be able to speak about what real moral impulses are. And we shall see that it is not merely words, but realities that are at work in the soul, and that establish morality. The end of Lecture 1.